Hello and welcome to Behind the Health Statistic. My name is Ricky Hellier and I'm a lecturer at Cardiff University School of Healthcare Sciences. Today I'll be talking to my colleague Mandy Brimble about her experience of growing up with a dad with epilepsy. So what is epilepsy? Epilepsy is a neurological condition, a condition of the brain. It causes symptoms such as fits and changes in sensation. Causes of epilepsy can range. It can be from a lack of oxygen shortly after birth. It can be because of things such as stroke or trauma to the head, or even down to things such as alcohol and drug misuse. Epilepsy usually starts in childhood or in people over 60, but it can start at any age. We think there's around about 600,000 people in the UK living with epilepsy, and that's around about one in every 100 people. Epilepsy Research UK suggests that the disorder kills around about 21 people per week in the UK, and people with the condition die on average 8 years earlier than the rest of the population. And now over to Mandy, who kindly shares her story with us.
Morning, Mandy.
Morning, Ricky.
So, can you start just by telling us a little bit about yourself, really?
Yeah, I'm a senior lecturer here in the School of Healthcare Sciences. I've worked here for quite some time now. I'm a children's nurse by background, and my clinical experience was on children's medical wards, outpatients. I'm also a health visitor as well. I've worked in a children's hospice in an education role, and I suppose my main area of interest is paediatric palliative care, amongst many others. So, you know, that's my professional background. So I suppose the reason that I've come to talk to you today is about my dad, who had epilepsy. My dad's epilepsy arose through a trauma. He was dropped down some concrete steps when he was about seven by a friend in school who was giving him a piggyback up the stairs, and unfortunately dropped him. And very soon after that, my father started to have seizures. And I suppose it's quite an old-fashioned thing, but my grandparents were told that your body changes every 7 years. And so my grandparents were thinking, oh, when he's 14, he might grow out of it. And then when he's 21, he might grow out of it. But he never did. And it was a lifelong problem for him. He was never, even as a young person, very compliant with his treatment. And that continued really throughout his life. I think he was probably a little bit embarrassed by his condition, and certainly I would say now, looking back on it, my grandparents were probably a little bit embarrassed about it as well, and it was kind of hidden away and not talked about very much. And I suppose particularly as he would have, I mean, knowing what I know now about children's development, particularly when he got to be an adolescent, I would have thought, you know, when you really, really want to fit in with your peers and so on, that would have been a prime time really for him to be trying to hide it and just trying to be normal and not having to take medication. And because he was never very compliant, he had lots of admissions to hospital. In fact, that's how he met my mum, because she was a nurse and she looked after my father on the ward. And obviously after that, you know, they formed a relationship and ended up getting married. So yeah, I think it was, you know, and certainly then very, very much of a stigma around anything like that, anything to do with your brain, I suppose, that wasn't quite normal. And I suppose, you know, as a child, I was kind of aware of it, obviously, from a very young age, because of the poor control over the condition because of the non-compliance with the medication. And certainly I think it took a while before I became very aware that, you know, not everybody's father had this condition. You know, you suddenly come to that realization that maybe there's something a little bit different. And I suppose that kind of stigma in a way kind of perpetuated itself. It was kind of, I'm not saying that I was embarrassed of my dad, I wasn't, but I was kind of, I was very wary about the unpredictability of the condition. And also as a young child, I can remember being quite anxious, I suppose, because my father was continually kind of in denial. He would do things like smoke in the house on his own or go in the bath and lock the bathroom door. And that's kind of one of, not my earliest memories, but one of my childhood memories of my mother and father having a bit of an altercation, because obviously my mum was concerned about my dad's safety, but my father just wanted to carry on as normal and lock the bathroom door, obviously for a bit of privacy or whatever. So I suppose that, you know, the other thing as well is I can remember going to school concerts and things and being on the stage and kind of being very aware sometimes when my dad was having we called them petit mal seizures then, but a minor seizure, and that, you know, there was kind of a bit of a flurry in the audience of people kind of looking around to see what this kind of movement was behind them, and, you know, being on the stage and being utterly mortified that all this attention was being drawn to my dad. You know, I mean, my mum coped with it really, really well, because she was a nurse, of, you know, obviously, and, you know, she just attended to my dad and you know, got on with it, really, I suppose. And yeah, I, you know, I was embarrassed to tell my friends. I think it was only my very best friend in school that I would really have round to the house on a regular basis. And kind of, you know, my father sometimes had seizures when she was around, and she, you know, she just kind of carried on as normal and never made me feel that that was anything to be embarrassed about, really. And yeah, I suppose I kind of went all the way through school thinking that it was something that had to be hidden and embarrassed about. But actually, interestingly, when I was in comprehensive school, my parents had got divorced by then, and my father was living with my grandparents, and he'd been out shopping in the local town where we live one day, and he'd had a major seizure actually in the shopping centre where we live. And I kind of knew about it, obviously, from my grandparents and things, but I overheard somebody in my class then talking about it, and I was kind of in the corner thinking, oh, you know, what are they going to say, and do, you know, do they know that that was my dad, and worrying about that. But actually the boy in my class that was talking about it said, oh, what an awful condition to have, that, you know, there you are walking around town doing your shopping, and, you know, that happens to you. I mean, my father fell, and he was quite, not badly injured, but, you know, he had a gash to his head and so on, and obviously a crowd gathered because he was having this major seizure. And I suppose, and I've never spoken to that friend, you know, school friend, about it. I still live in the, you know, the town that I was brought up and went to school, but that was kind of a bit of a light bulb moment for me, I suppose, really. And kind of a reassurance that people weren't gonna kind of take the mick out of me, because my father had epilepsy. So really, I should have thanked that person, because it really gave me kind of another perspective about what people might think about that condition. So it was, I suppose, really reassuring that there were people out there that really did understand. So I suppose it didn't limit anything necessarily that I did as a child, because my mother's quite a robust person and very, very determined. So she wouldn't have ever thought we're not doing that because, you know, John might have a seizure. She would have just carried on as normal. So it didn't restrict us, apart from the fact that obviously my father couldn't drive because of his condition. So my mother was always the driver in the family. My father was supposed to be the navigator, but that never went very well, to the extent that I ended up being the navigator from quite a young age. So no, it didn't limit what we did, but it did definitely raise my anxiety levels about whatever we did, just in case my father had a seizure. And I suppose the, you know, the really sad thing for my dad was, and for us, of course, that when he was living with my grandparents then, when my parents had got divorced, he was at the top of the stairs one day and had a seizure, and fell down the stairs, and was knocked unconscious. That actually resulted in him being in a coma. And as is the case sometimes now, but definitely then, so we're talking about a number of years ago, that because he was immobile, he had a chest infection and kidney failure, and unfortunately died then at the age of 42 when I was 16. So I can remember thinking at the time, oh gosh, 42 is really young to die, but when you're 16, 42 is still quite old. So it wasn't really until I got to that age myself, well, in fact, when I got to 32, I thought, gosh, I've been alive now for double the time since I'd lost my dad. And when I got to 42, I was thinking, gosh, my, you know, my father's life was over by now. And, you know, obviously at 42, I was just imagining, you know, much longer future, obviously, for me. I think back now and I think about, you know, obviously, you know, time has gone on, I've got married, I've got children, I've got two grandchildren, and I think about the, you know, the things that he missed out on. But I suppose, you know, you have to move forward. You can't keep looking back all the time. But, you know, I often think, you know, maybe if he'd been a little bit more compliant with his medication, then, you know, his condition would have been controlled better. So maybe there wouldn't have been all those incidences of my father having seizures, you know, unexpectedly when, you know, when we were out and about and things. And, you know, certainly I don't know what he was doing with his medication at that particular time when he had that last fall, but, you know, I often wonder whether he would have still been here today. And obviously treatments have developed so much more since then, that maybe he would have been a little bit kind of healthier into kind of his later adulthood and so on. So it definitely did affect me, and it was a difficult thing to live with, but probably it, you know, it's probably made me the person that I am now. I am very sensitive. I would definitely say I'm much more like my dad, actually, than my mum. She was quite a stroppy person, and my father was very placid. And, you know, I do have a lot of his traits, I think. But, yeah, I think that's it, actually. I don't know whether you had any kind of questions to ask.
It's so interesting, and as quite often with this, I get a lump in my throat when I'm listening to it. I'm like, oh man, you know, it's brings lots of things.
Yeah,
you know,
sorry, you carry on.
No, so I was just going to say, you know, even down to listening to, you know, the stories of you as a little girl and thinking about house, it's quite often, and I suppose that the thing that we wanted to get with these podcasts is that, you know, we think about a disorder, but we don't realise the impact it has, one disorder might have on other people. We don't sometimes realise, we think of it as being, I don't know, asthma, epilepsy, something, without realising that there's this whole family dynamic to health, isn't there, you know? So when you talked about your dad, that when you were little, and that worry, it's funny, I see that in my own daughters. If I do something stupid or if I'm up a ladder, no matter how little they are, they panic, don't they, you know?
I suppose in some ways it's kind of putting adult responsibilities on young shoulders as well, you know, because I can remember, you know, my mum, we weren't very often left on our own with my dad, but we were very, very kind of versed and trained in what to do with my dad, how to put him in the recovery position and, you know, that kind of thing. So I suppose in a way, you're putting adult responsibilities on young shoulders there in a way, but we never felt, because it was me and my brother and he was 3 years younger than me, or is 3 years younger than me, we never felt, you know, kind of put upon or anything. You know, at the end of the day, it was my dad, you know, of course we were, you know, we were gonna look after him. But yes, it's kind of, and you know, it's really funny because I didn't do my degree until kind of much later in life. You know, I was in school. I liked school. I did fairly well in what were the O levels then, so the equivalent of GCSEs. And I did stay on to do A levels. But I can always kind of remember, you know, when they were the UCA forms then, the predecessor to UCAS, and I can remember all the other people, you know, at the kind of Christmas time filling in their UCA forms for university, and for me that was kind of, nobody in my family had gone to university, but it was so far out of my reach, I felt, because I always felt that other people were better than me. And that's not because anybody at school made me feel that. My mother was like, you can achieve anything that you want. But I think it was that kind of, that anxiety and that worry from a young age that just made me feel, I suppose, that I was just that little bit different and I wasn't good enough. Yeah. And it wasn't until later life that, you know, I came into nursing and I did really, really well and I thrived. And that is the thing that's given me the confidence to do other things, I suppose. I don't know whether that's necessarily to do with my father's epilepsy, but, you know, because I know lots of people will feel like that and they won't flourish until later life. But definitely, you know, that thing of being different, and because of that difference, feeling like I wasn't good enough, I suppose.
I suppose you wouldn't have had maybe, I mean, there's been a lot of focus on what we would term young carers nowadays. Mm. And, you know, I very much doubt that even entered in people's psyche, even only a few years ago, you know, and that support mechanism there for you.
Yeah, I agree. And I suppose, like I say, my grandparents were fairly kind of embarrassed about the whole thing and, you know, didn't really talk about it with us. So that, you know, there wasn't kind of that outlet. And because my mum's from Greece, you know, the other grandparents weren't here. So it was just mainly that side of the family. And my dad had a sister who was quite a lot younger than him, and I think because of, you know, obviously she was brought up by the same parent, she was quite embarrassed about it all as well, so there wasn't really I didn't really have anybody to talk to, I suppose, about it. And that was probably the kind of main problem, you know. So there was kind of me and my brother, my mum getting on with it. So apart from my brother, who was obviously in the same situation as me, there was nobody else to talk to. So I think that was probably, you know, and because people didn't talk about it, I didn't know how common it was either. So that probably kind of escalated the whole kind of, oh God, this is a really weird thing to have and it's really different and, you know, there's something wrong with your dad's brain. So, you know, gosh, you know, aren't you a weirdo kind of thing? No, nobody was saying that to me, but that's how I kind of perceived the whole way that other people would look at me, I think, and kind of the reactions from people as well, you know, when we were out and about, if my dad had a seizure, well, all that did was just kind of escalate those feelings further, really. Like I say, until I was in comprehensive school and that person in my class kind of made that observation, and I thought, oh, there are people out there that would be kind about it. So, yeah, that was a bit of a revelation for me. I can remember it as clear as day, even now. When, you know, I'm 55 now, and this would have been when I was about, well, it was before my dad died, obviously. So it would have been when I was about 13, I think.
It shows how important kindness is, doesn't it, really? You know, when.
Yeah, absolutely.
And sometimes, you know, we see a lot more nowadays with kids. If either whether they're living with the condition themselves or they're living, you know, their parents live or sibling lives with a condition as well, there's a, you know, I'd like to think there's that encouragement of acceptance now.
Yeah, much more so, I think, than men, really. So, yeah.
How is it sort of, you know, with you now? Because it's really interesting what you said. And it is something when you say numbers, isn't it? You know, when you said 42, I thought, I'm 42. And it's bizarre, isn't it? And how you measure yourself and you measure, you know, like in your case, that longevity against your dad and that. You know, looking at your dad and how has it changed? I don't know. It's obviously impact. It sounds like it's impacted on the career choice you took. But how has it on you personally and your views of health and stuff?
I think probably, I think we all try to be healthy, don't we? My mum was quite strict, but I think, and, you know, probably, I mean, crikey, if a psychologist analysed me, they probably have lots to say about this, but I think because my dad didn't comply with his medication, and because I saw the effects of that, it has made me such a rule follower.
Right.
So anybody will tell you, oh, Mandy will follow the rules to the nth degree. You know, every I has got to be dotted, every T has got to be crossed. I really, really am a rule follower, and I'm not sure whether that comes from that, but yeah, I mean, we all try to be role models, I think, as nurses, don't we? But you know, I wouldn't dream of going out on my bike without a bicycle helmet on, because that is what you should do, you know. And you know, maybe that's a bit of my health promotion head on as well as a health visitor, but I do feel that it has made me, I'm very compliant with any rule, whether it's to do with life, you know. I think that's why I like working in the university, because everything is, tends to be, you know, we follow a timetable and we do this. And obviously nursing has, you know, policies and procedures and things like that. So I think that probably makes me feel quite secure.
Yeah.
Because probably I felt so out of control when I was younger, with my dad's condition and things like that. So, just give me a rule and I'll follow it. And I won't do anything different until you tell me it's okay to do that. Which probably makes me quite boring, but it makes me feel secure. And that, I think that probably comes a little bit from that. So, certainly in terms of risk taking, I am not a risk taker at all.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? How we sort of like pick, it's, you know, in terms of what we inherit from our parents and the sort of how they act, it either drives us to be exactly like them or the opposite direction.
The complete opposite. But, you know, like I say, it wasn't until I got kind of older, really, and I started to learn about child development and things like that, that I really understood why my dad would want to be in denial about his condition and, you know, why he didn't, you know, comply with the medication, really. I understand, but unfortunately for him and for us, the non-compliance with the treatment was then the thing that made the condition even more apparent than maybe it needed to be. I suppose that's something for me to take into my teaching about adolescent development, really, because we get a lot of that in adolescents. They just don't want to be different. They don't want to take their medication.
So. Funny, because I used to see a lot with people with diabetes, because my background's ITU, and adolescents coming in with something called diabetic ketoacidosis, which you'll know what it is, Mandy, but that was quite often from young people who just didn't want to comply. So a lot of that's down to the reasons they don't want to be different. But it seemed like with your dad, is compliance carried on? Is non-compliance carried on?
Definitely. I think that was probably to do with my grandparents, all through his life and, you know, into his adulthood. They just didn't want to admit, really, I think, that he had this condition. He just never, you know, despite the fact that he was then married to a nurse who would have been banging on about complying with the treatment, I'm sure, and so frustrated by the whole situation, which is maybe why my parents got divorced. But, you know, despite being an adult and living with somebody who could educate him as to, you know, why he needed to, well, obviously he knew why he needed to take it, but, you know, the effect and the benefits of complying with the treatment, I suppose, that still didn't work. So it would have been interesting, I suppose, to know what would have worked for him, you know, what would have been the persuading factor. Obviously we'll never know, but it's interesting, you know, how people's minds work in terms of accepting a problem and accepting treatment, isn't it? And I suppose, it's different for everybody.
Yeah. Oh, Mandy, thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
You're very welcome.
It's really appreciated. I'm sure the students listening and the people in the public who are listening will have found it really valuable. So thanks for that, Mandy.
Oh, not at all. Thank you.
All right now. Cheers then. Thank you. Bye now.
Thanks. Bye.
So a huge thank you to Mandy for sharing a really powerful story with us. If you'd like more information on epilepsy, please look at the NHS website and organisations such as the Epilepsy Society. If you're interested in young carers, please look at organisations such as Carers UK and Young Minds. A huge thank you also to Pete Smith from Cardiff University School of Healthcare Sciences for producing this episode. Thank you.